You're listening to Agile Ideas, the podcast, hosted by Fatima Ibuchi.
For anyone listening out there not having a good day, please know there is help out there. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Agile Ideas. I'm Fatima, CEO at Agile Management Office, Mental Health Ambassador, and your host. This podcast is made possible thanks to Agile Management Office. We help businesses in three key ways: improving organizational culture and delivery, supporting transformation and change, and streamlining governance and process. We use 20 years of proven practice and the AMO Way proprietary model. In today's episode, I am very excited to announce that I will be speaking to Alice Brover. Alice is a recognized IT leader with a track record over three decades of building and leading world-class IT organizations, driving transformational change and delivering tangible business value. His experience spans a range of roles and industries across a range of organizational scales, from startups to multinationals. Most recently, Alice was CIO of Toyota Australia, where he led a transformation of the IT function from an internally focused service provider to a strategic enabler, driver of innovation, and role model for outstanding customer service. Alice grew and led a team of 300 people that delivered an industry-leading digital business capability, as well as a rapid transformation in cybersecurity maturity, whilst dramatically improving efficiency and contributing to business growth. Alice is now pursuing independent advisory and consulting opportunities, aiming to add value to the business success of organizations and the development of their people through an effective IT function. Needless to say, I'm very excited to have Alice on the show. We're going to cover off a range of topics, from everything around challenges and opportunities within the IT industry, how important it is to connect IT to other areas of the business, such as marketing, what the real IT issues that sit below the top line that is shared with consultants, types of initiatives that ELT will actually fund, how the rapid pace of technological changes and advances have implications on the way we work, IT operating models, cybersecurity, digital transformation, and so much more. So please join me in welcoming Alice Brover to the show. Welcome, Alice, to the show. We've just given everyone a bit of an overview about yourself, but tell us something about you that most people wouldn't know.
Yeah, thanks, Fatima. Good to be here. Something that most people about me wouldn't know. I guess probably people get surprised that in my personal life, away from work, I tend to be a little bit of a technophobe, even though my job is technology, obviously, and I like technology. So things like a watch that we just talked about before, where I like good old-fashioned analog watches rather than smart watches. I don't like smart fridges. I don't like smart homes. So yeah, maybe I'm a little bit of a Luddite when it comes to my personal life. I like to get away from the tech a bit.
It makes sense. I think I always say, going into a hairdresser and you see their hair is not done for the day, it's like they just can't really be bothered worrying about that. They take care of their clients first. That's the most important thing, and then getting to that as well. So interesting. And what was the best thing that happened to you in the last week, or the most frustrating?
Best thing that happened to me in the last week probably was I had a birthday, and I got a very lovely touching card from my kids, which means a lot.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
So we've got probably a lot of things that we could talk about and a lot of things to cover, but one of the things that I would like to sort of touch on is, a lot of the time when we think about our careers, we often don't know where we're going to end up. And some people do. Some people know that they were always destined to be, CEO or similar. Is it something that you knew early on in life that you wanted to sort of head down that path, or did it just naturally happen throughout your career?
Yeah, not at all. I had no idea, and I think if you talked to me earlier in my career, I probably would have laughed at the notion. I started off in a very technical field. I was a software dev. I loved what I was doing. And thought that, to the extent that I thought ahead, I guess I expected that's probably what I would continue to do. I think at one point in my career, I unexpectedly sort of got a chance to do a small-scale leadership gig and found that I enjoyed it. I wasn't expecting to enjoy it, but I liked the sense of being able to make a bigger difference through a team than I could make on my own. And I guess things sort of went from there. But to be honest, probably right up until just before I became a CIO, I really wasn't thinking that I would want to be a CIO.
Amazing. And do you think that in the time that you've been a CIO, what would you say have been the biggest changes in that sort of that tenure in the industry overall that you've seen?
I mean, IT is always going through massive changes, isn't it? Every few years, it feels like a new generation. I've spent, I guess, my recent past in the automotive industry, and certainly that industry's gone through some huge changes. So if we look at Toyota, for example, obviously there was the closure of manufacturing industry in Australia, which was not just Toyota, but all the other OEMs as well. That was, of course, a massive disruption in terms of people impact, strategy, business impact, IT. Digital, I mean, we're hardly the only industry that's been digitally disrupted, but we absolutely have been going through a lot of digital disruption, and that's created an enormous amount of more demand for IT than was ever there before. And connected vehicles, of course, in our industry have been the big thing, the big growing expectation from consumers. So I think those three things alone have been more than enough to keep a CIO busy, let alone all of the changes in broader IT industry developments in technology and growth in cyber threats and all that other stuff.
Yeah, and then add the whole story of COVID as well into that, and it just makes things a lot more complicated.
Hybrid working and supply chain disruption.
Yes.
Resource shortages. Yes. Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, a lot of organisations, their IT was at the forefront of helping people to, because a lot of companies weren't set up for remote working, and so that was a big shift and a big change at scale. And being the size of the team that you had, was that something that you guys were prepared for? Were you already doing some remote working anyway, or was it completely new?
It was almost completely new. I mean, we had it happening to a very limited extent. It was, a pretty traditional culture. There was very much an expectation of being there. So unless there was some exceptional reason for working from home, generally people were expected to be in the office. So we really weren't set up. And when it happened, it was a kind of mad scramble within, you know, a couple of short days to set up all of the IT infrastructure to allow, you know, secure working from home. But team did an awesome job, made it happen pretty seamlessly, and that actually made a huge difference that I think is often underappreciated to the thousands of people that were then able to work productively. Mm-hmm. We take it for granted that it's obvious you can log on and do your work, but of course under the hood it's not quite so obvious. So a great job was done there, but of course then there's all the people impacts of that, all the cultural impacts of learning how to work remotely, how to make it work effectively. I think as an industry we're still learning that very much.
Do you think that, you know, with the rapid pace of technological changes and advancements, of course, no doubt there's been implications on the way that teams and organisations work. What were some of the surprising elements for you that you saw there?
In terms of hybrid working specifically?
Yeah.
I think what I learned essentially was it depends on what you're doing. There were some things that actually worked more efficiently that maybe surprised a lot of executives in the company, that a lot of people actually got more done in the quiet environment of home without the distractions, without the travel time wastage and so on. But for me anyway, what I also learned is some things really do benefit massively from face-to-face, and that sort of collaborative problem solving, building relationships, having difficult conversations with people, coaching people, those things really benefit enormously from face-to-face. I think what allowed us to make it work over those couple of years of lockdowns was trading off existing relationships.
Yes.
In many cases, especially in an established company with a lot of long-term people, it's a lot easier to do that when you already have relationships with people and you're just transacting, mm-hmm. so to speak. When you're building new relationships with people, it's really, really hard. And I always felt for those people who are coming in new to the organisation and who for many months didn't actually meet anybody else in the company face-to-face, mm-hmm. very, very hard to get a sense of the culture of who's who, what the processes are, how things work. And I think the impact of the sort of the body language is often underestimated. I had the experience of sitting on a board for a while there through lockdowns, and of course we had virtual board meetings every month, and they were okay, they worked, they got through the agenda, but when we finally, in between lockdowns, got to actually travel and have the first face-to-face board meeting, I found it more effective than the previous year's worth put together.
Yeah.
Because you could see when someone was uncomfortably shuffling in their seat, mm-hmm. you could take them aside during coffee and have a quiet face-to-face chat.
Yeah.
You could, you know, realise and resolve issues much quicker rather than just kind of nodding the head and going through an agenda. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult online to sense whether someone's just being quiet because they don't want to speak up and disrupt things, but actually they've got a point to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or are they distracted, especially with the campus off situation? Yeah, definitely. There was quite a lot of that, actually. A lot of organisations with, you know, the camera, the whole camera off situation, which, you know, does make it really hard, like, to read body language. Body language is a key component as well. So, yeah, I think you were definitely not alone in that chat being a challenge as well. But it's good to start seeing people coming back. We're in the CBD today, so it's good to see people coming back into the office as well, which is, I think, is great. I'm interested in touching on the relationship between IT and the rest of the business. I feel like IT is generally quite misunderstood in a lot of organisations. Why do you think that IT is often misunderstood by its business counterparts?
Well, I think there's probably two main reasons for me. One is, let's be honest, it's still a fairly new and immature field. In many ways, it's still more of an art than a science. We don't have really well-established, consistent processes, methods, terminology, like, say, engineering does. I often liken it to engineering. We're not at that point, but engineering has had hundreds of years of history. IT hasn't. So I think that's one reason. And I think another reason is because the flip side of that is that everybody is exposed to so much IT in their daily life on the consumer side. And a lot of lay people feel that is what IT is all about. Mm-hmm. They focus on the consumer side. It's the laptop, it's the phones. How hard can it be?
Mm-hmm.
You guys deliver us laptops and phones, you give us logins, you give us Microsoft Office. Great.
Yep.
Why do you need all these people? What are they all doing?
Yes.
What makes it so hard?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a real communication and education challenge there, but it's kind of natural, I think, you know, in a new developing field.
And how important is it to actually connect IT to the other areas of the business, you know, with marketing, sales, etc.? Like, what is part of that educational journey? There's sort of some recommendations that you'd make.
Well, I think it's crucial. I mean, I think we can't be arrogant in IT. We have to recognise that at the end of the day, in most companies, we are a service department. We're there to serve the business, whether it's marketing, whether it's sales, whether it's manufacturing, whatever the business of your company is. I think it's important to always keep that in mind. Your success is ultimately going to be measured by what your customers think of you.
Mm-hmm.
And usually those customers are the business, I hate to use that term, but your internal counterparts. So I think if you can't connect to them, then you're ultimately going to be irrelevant. And they will find other ways to achieve what they need to achieve. If you can't make yourself relevant to them and deliver what they need in an appropriate way, then shadow IT will result, as it does in many companies. And I think one of the risks of that for our industry, maybe it's a slight tangent, is the kind of the decline of the role of the CIO is, I think, a real danger that we have to be careful of. And to me, a lot of the reason for that is because I think many of us as CIOs really aren't managing to gain credibility and gain relevance with those business stakeholders.
Yeah.
Of course, we need to also focus on the back end of IT, on security and operations and service desk and all those other things that the business maybe doesn't see as glamorous. But if you can't also do the things that the business actually does need, then, you know, it's inevitable that you're going to lose relevance.
It's really interesting you say that. Shadow IT is definitely something that we're seeing quite frequently with a number of clients, and until other parts of the business realise how they can they replace and not have to deal with IT, because they only necessarily focus on the negative sometimes. But I think you're right, education, definitely key. And even one of the things I think that maybe IT departments don't do often is marketing themselves. You know, if you think about all the other departments in an organisation, they market themselves so well. Maybe IT can take some lessons from marketing and actually market themselves better, perhaps, do you think?
Yeah, I think absolutely you're right, and I'm not going to claim to be any kind of marketing expert, but I think that's an issue many of us have who've come up through a technical background. We're not naturally comfortable with marketing ourselves, so to speak. But I think to some extent it's something that you're right, you've got to be able to do. I think for me also my experience was a lot of it comes down to just gaining credibility through small steps. Most people that you deal with inside organisations are fundamentally well-intentioned. They want what's best for the organisation.
Mm-hmm.
They might just have a different perspective to you. They might have some pre-existing history that they've experienced before of, oh, IT is always slow and expensive to deliver, so I don't want to use them. You've got to get over that perception, and you can do that through lots of blitzy marketing, or you can do it through actually delivering.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to start small, so... You know, my kind of approach to it in the early days when I had that issue of a lot of shadow IT was essentially to tell my people, don't walk into a meeting with your business counterparts and say no. Your job is not to say no. It seems kind of crazy because, you know, we all know there are things you need to say no to as an IT division. But when you're in that space, when the business is already doing shadow IT anyway, they're going to do it without you. And if you walk in and say no, you'll just make sure that you don't get invited to the next meeting.
Yes.
So my advice early on was don't go in and say no, only open your mouth if you've actually got something, some value to add to the problem that that your business counterpart is trying to solve. If you can solve it quicker, more securely, more efficiently, with higher quality, fantastic, speak up and do it. If all you're doing is to say, no, that's not a good idea, that doesn't meet our standard, we're not in that space where we're able to say that. That comes maybe with time when you've built up the credibility.
Yes.
And all the IT workers going through the IT division, then yeah, maybe you kind of get licensed to say, no, we're not doing that in some cases when it's not appropriate. But early on, I think recognize that you're on the back foot, you're a service department, you've got to gain your relevance. You've got to get a seat at the table.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the gain your relevance comment. That's really, really important. And I think it's underestimated. Sometimes people and in these sort of roles may take it for granted. So you definitely need to maintain relevance. It's really interesting because one of the things we see quite frequently, and obviously we did some work together as well, is about that front door into IT. So usually, obviously IT's got their own strategic objectives that they're trying to meet, but then business wants this and they want that, and sometimes they're willing to pay for it, other times they're not. So I guess how important is it, have you seen, of having sort of, whatever we want to call it, but that demand management pipeline front door piece, and having the business involved in that so they can share their ideas and you can hear them out, even if not everything they want is going to get delivered?
Yeah, incredibly important. The last thing I think you want as an IT group is to be blindsided at the last minute with, by the way, we need these multi-million-dollar projects done, and you know we need them done in 3 months, and oh, you're not resourced, oh, you haven't planned ahead for it. So, yeah, some of the most important roles I recruited, I think, were what we called business engagement partners, and some of the most challenging roles to recruit as well, I think, because you're really looking for a very special breed of person that's, yeah, sure, they've got the IT acumen, they've got some project delivery under their belt, and they understand what an SDLC looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got business acumen, they've got interpersonal skills, they've got influencing skills. They're able to interact with often fairly senior stakeholders who sometimes are very busy and sometimes have very different perspectives on things, and to gain their trust and to offer them concrete solutions. So I think it's a really important role.
Absolutely, and it's like I said, it's someone who has the right skills that they can talk the business language, but then understand IT as well. So, yeah, absolutely.
And be able to influence, because sometimes, unfortunately, the job is to say, that's a really great idea, but actually, it doesn't make sense to do that until we've done this other thing, until we've done, you know, we put these building blocks in place. Or, that's a really great idea. Do you know your counterparts in other divisions are actually looking at something very similar?
Yes.
Why don't we get you together and look at doing it in common? So
absolutely. It's kind of like that integration point of dependency management of all of those different parts of the moving parts of the organization. So thinking about strategy, so what does it mean to set the right IT strategy?
I mean, look, I think it means lots of things, but to me probably the number one thing that is often overlooked is deciding what you're not going to do. I find a lot of the temptation in setting strategy is to be over ambitious. Often we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to do this, and often it ends up just sitting on the shelf because it's not realistic, it's never going to happen. So I think the toughest thing in it is actually to work out, to genuinely prioritise, and that means what you're going to say no to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some things that may be really valuable initiatives and really ought to be done, but you've got to sacrifice, you've got to actually put them off in favour of other higher priority initiatives. It means sometimes some tough conversations with your business counterparts, because you've got to be able to say, actually, we can't do everything for everybody and achieve a decent level of quality and live within budget and within resource constraints and so on. So that prioritisation, I think, is the key to it.
Who would you say, in terms of roles, are the major roadblocks or change resistors? If you want to answer that one.
I mean, without naming specific names, I guess, but in general, I think there's a personality type that just doesn't want to change,
mm-hmm.
and that's, you know. Without criticising it, that's just human nature. And often, many of us, we've been in organisations for a long time, we've adapted to the way it works, whether it's good or bad or indifferent, but we don't like it to change. But apart from that, of course, there's just the natural human tendency of, if you are seen to be threatening somebody's position, somebody's perceived status,
mm-hmm.
somebody's resourcing or budget, it's pretty natural to expect that they're going to resist.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, for many of us, it's a corporate environment and those things are important. So I think it's about understanding your stakeholders' motivations, It's about really trying to put yourself in their shoes, the classic empathy thing, and work out what are the wins for them, what are the threats for them. You can't always make it work, you can't always please everybody, but trying to put yourself in their shoes and understand, I think, helps you to sometimes get around some of the detractors in a more effective way than just kind of beating people over the head and hoping they'll agree.
Carrot and the stick, both. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm thinking now from an executive leadership team perspective, and I'm being a bit selfish here being a consultancy myself, what types of initiatives do you find that ERTs typically fund, and what don't they?
I mean, I guess the trite answer is, you know, boards tend to focus on profitability and risk, so anything that, you know, generates top line revenue directly or anything that you know, de-risks significantly is obviously going to get attention, right? But I think IT project prioritization is really complex. It's not something that generally you can realistically expect a board to go through. It's a complex art, as you know, balancing your resource constraints, your strategic drivers versus your operational needs, your budget pressures, all of those things. So I find that in organizations where the CIO or the IT division has established good credibility and trust with the board, often that will be delegated. So the ELT will generally sign off on a plan that the CIO recommends as being achievable and well balanced. Where I think the board can really help the IT division is to set the high level parameters and priorities. These are our top five strategic initiatives. Mm-hmm. We expect you to devote, let's say, 50% of your budget in rough terms to these things because we've got to get them done. The rest, you know, we trust you to work out what makes the most sense for the organization, balance the operational needs, the cybersecurity risk with the benefit projects and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I find that is very much, it comes down to the CIO being able to actually play devil's advocate, represent the organization. That means being close to the business. That means obviously understanding the business, understanding and knowing your stakeholders, because you're making some really important judgments on behalf of the organization.
And you've got a seat at the table as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So thinking about budget, if you had more budget than what you had, what would you have done differently if budget was greater than what it was, do you think?
It probably sounds funny, but actually budget was rarely my key constraint.
Okay.
In my experience. The challenge was being able to turn that budget into the right resources in the right way. That's where the bottlenecks always ended up being.
Mm-hmm.
Headcount constraints in many organizations are often more challenging than budgets, at least in good economic times. You may have the money, but you may not be able to hire internal staff with that money because you've got headcount constraints. But even if you do, and whether you're hiring staff or contractors, being able to find the right people in a timely way, with the right culture fit, with the right skills, integrated into the team in the right way, that was always for me the bottleneck. It was about the human element. It wasn't so much about the dollars.
Okay. And it's only exacerbated in these recent times as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, more than ever.
Yeah. Do you see other sort of, and you don't have to be in the specifics, but do you see other sort of issues that are commonly shared with sort of consultancy? Like, we've got this issue or that issue. What kind of are some of the common issues that really that sits underneath the ERT that people then get engaged to support?
Many and varied, but certainly setting operating models, integrating digital strategy with IT. Obviously, in your space, effective project delivery and project governance are big ones. The whole sort of outsourcing versus insourcing space, I think, is interesting. And again, one of those major challenges for a CIO role is to really deeply think about what has to be in-house, because often there's a temptation to make those decisions based on short-term constraints,
mm-hmm.
budget, the headcount, and so on. But actually, of course, it should be about deciding what genuinely is differentiating for the organization and what needs organizational intimacy to be effective. And you really need to fight to have those things in-house. And unfortunately, that in many organizations means you letting go of things that are maybe being done very effectively in-house, mm-hmm. but that are more commodity in nature. They may be very important and they've got to be done right, but they're not differentiating. They're done the same way in multiple organizations. Those are generally the things that you can outsource. But these things are all easy on paper,
yeah.
on a strategy document. Mm-hmm. They're much, much harder to do in practice, of course, when you're dealing with real life constraints and more importantly, when you're dealing with people.
Did you see a shift in the market? Did you see a shift in what was insource and outsource sort of in the last couple of years during the COVID times compared to maybe 5 years prior?
I think a lot I saw was really driven by resource constraints. So, for example, in cybersecurity, we found organizations like the one that I was in, it was almost impossible to attract and retain good cybersecurity people. In a kind of crazy market that we're in that's changing all the time. Mm-hmm. So it was more pragmatic, whether it was the right thing to do or not, to source those skills through vendors. And I think the good news probably is many vendors in Australia do seem to be building up their cybersecurity capability pretty well. They do have an ability to attract and retain good cybersecurity people. I mean, they also have their struggles, but maybe not as many as a typical corporate does with its own constraints. So that was probably one area where I saw more of a tendency to outsource. Again, coming back to my earlier comment, I still think the strategy for it should absolutely be in-house, mm-hmm. however hard that is, but you've got to fight to make sure that the key decisions around your cybersecurity, what controls make sense for your organization, what don't, how to implement them, that should come from in-house. Mm-hmm. But the actual doing, we found we could outsource with varying degrees of success, but their resource constraints I think are a big driver.
And I think, is it fair to say as well that not only can once you outsource, it's not you just set and forget, you actually need to have a plan to manage that internally. As you're saying, you have to have a strategy around that as well.
Very much so. You've got to have the strategy in-house, but you've got to have your vendor management in-house as well. And mm-hmm. I think that's another really tough thing. Again, typically, a lot of IT departments have people who've come up through technical ranks, as I have, mm-hmm. who've got great technical skills, but are maybe not necessarily trained or expert in vendor management. I think that's another area where sort of we as CIOs really have to try a bit harder to make sure that we get those right skills in, because often these days we're outsourcing some very, very large and critical areas for the organisation. And if they're not effectively managed, they do tend to devolve. You know, mm-hmm. It's not because vendors are all evil and want to get away with something wrong, but it's just the nature of the beast that these things need to be managed, and they need to be managed in a way that makes sense for the organisation. It's not just a matter of holding people to the letter of a contract. It's a matter of making sure that they're meeting the expectations of your customers in your organisation.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we see as a typical challenge as well is that vendors come in with their own ways of working, their own methodologies, their own governance approaches. That needs to integrate well with the organisation. Otherwise, you've got a disconnect. So you have so many vendors and suppliers, and then you've got different ways of working. It's like having a way to manage that, and a vendor management function, particularly that's well integrated with operations and projects, is going to make all the difference as well.
Yeah, for sure. So I think especially when you're doing project development, and particularly difficult, I think, to have that combination of outsourced vendors and in-house teams. And my view there, to be honest, is you've just got to, as an organization, have your own methodology, your own ways of doing things, and you've got to tell the vendors this is how you're doing things.
Yeah.
Just to put it in really simple terms, I know a lot of vendors like to, we've got our own flavor of agile, and we've got our own ways of working, we've got our own tools. That just doesn't work when you're going to have multiple vendors integrating. You're going to spend more time dealing with the handoff points and the differences and the miscommunication. So I think you've kind of got to put your foot down and say, in this case, we're not actually outsourcing, we're resource augmenting. You're working as part of our team to our standards, mm-hmm. under our management.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's different in other areas where you're generally outsourcing a commodity that maybe you don't have expertise in internally, mm-hmm. and where the vendor is exclusively responsible. If they're doing your data center, your infrastructure management, your network, in many of those cases, I actually prefer if the vendor has their own pre-existing way of doing things that's been refined and honed through experience of many, many clients.
Yes.
Because the theory is they can do it better than I can with my own people.
That's their core capabilities, not your organisation's. Yeah, absolutely. I want to just touch on, you mentioned cybersecurity. Where should an organisation focus in this space to prepare themselves to avoid being sort of a next cyber attack story?
Look, cyber security is obviously the flavour of the year or the decade or whatever it is. I'll start with the good news. The good news, I think, is that we've got the attention for a change. So years ago, I remember the CIO or the CISO would struggle to get the board's attention on cybersecurity issues. It just wasn't high on the agenda. So the good news, if you can put it that way, is that we now have the board's full attention. Every board is focused very, very closely on cybersecurity, and a combination of lots of highly publicised frequent attacks that cause a lot of impact, regulator attention, director responsibilities growing, and so on. So it's unfortunate that's happening, but the good news is the CISO's got the attention of the board. This is the time to make the most of that, so to speak, to get the most out of that. And I think you do that by, firstly, you lift the awareness of the board. You've got to understand that these are a bunch of highly intelligent, curious people, but in general, they're not cybersecurity or even IT experts. They don't need to be cybersecurity experts either, but they need to have a certain level of awareness to inform their top-level decision-making. You need the support of the entire company, not just IT. I think too often cybersecurity becomes an IT problem. It's something the IT division will take care of. I think that's a very narrow focus. So I guess my high-level advice would be, one, get the board on board, so to speak, establish an effective partnership, which can be hard to do. And secondly, broaden your focus beyond the technical controls. As IT people, that's what we all tend to focus on, is your MFAs and your VPNs and strong passwords and all the rest of it. And that's really important, and they've got to be done, but they're not enough. You've got to lift your gaze to things outside of the IT division's control, like having an effective BCP plan, having an effective crisis management plan. Because in my experience, often those are the things that actually matter the most when the chips are down and when you really do get attacked. It's those things that actually hurt you or that can save you even more than your technical preparedness.
And you mentioned earlier around the motivations of the ELT were profitability and de-risking. So this ties that's in right. directly. So this is probably why the CISOs have got us, you know, maybe more of a focus point now in this space as well. We talked about briefly digital, so digital and transformation. I'm interested to sort of learn from you about how you set up your organisation to deliver compelling business benefits quickly without losing control and carrying risk. And you might be able to link this to sort of the ways of working and how that's changing at the moment with traditional and agile and all of that feeding into that digital transformation umbrella.
Yeah, it's a huge topic and difficult to answer in a few bullet points. But I guess the first thing is my view is maybe different to some of the industry direction at the moment, is that digital delivery should be kept inside IT. I don't think it actually works very well when it's separate. The digital strategy, running the digital business, absolutely, that's not innately an IT skill, but actually delivering, actually creating your apps and your websites, I think fundamentally is IT development, and it belongs with other traditional IT development because it's a similar skill set, because you want consistent architecture, you want consistent processes. When you don't do that, you tend to develop long-term technical debt that's going to hurt the organization one day down the track. And again, that comes back to my earlier point that means ensuring the IT function is relevant to whether it's marketing or whichever other area, digital area in your organization that's setting your digital business direction. So I think the crucial thing is, firstly, ensure seamless collaboration between your product owners and your delivery teams. For me, always success looked like when you brought in an outside observer into your digital delivery team and they couldn't tell whether a person was from IT or from marketing because they were genuinely sitting together working as part of one team. It wasn't a sort of master-slave traditional project relationship. So I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing then is inside your IT group, making sure that it doesn't develop into your haves and have-nots. That's a natural risk that you have your kind of digital people working on the glamorous, high visibility, high benefit initiatives. And sometimes that's seen to sideline the people that are working on finance, general ledger systems, HR systems, operations, security, and so on. And that's a really hard thing to manage. But I think the art of the kind of, if you're going to try to be an effective leader of that as a CIO, is to work out where the differences are good and where they're not. To allow the differences to happen in terms of healthy tension, where it actually makes sense, where it makes sense for those two groups to work differently with different processes, but to force them to work together where they actually need to work together. It's a really hard, have a balance to find, but I think that's the way to get it done.
Absolutely. And it seems like every organisation is doing some form of digital transformation, but it seems never ending. It's like change is never ending. It's like we've got to get used to the fact that change is constant, as opposed to it's a thing we do. And especially with all the change fatigue going on at the moment, it's just like balancing that. And like I said earlier, getting that, getting clarity on the stakeholder motivations, and making sure that's factored in as well.
Look, I think one of the, whether you like it or whether you don't, but for me the exciting thing about the IT industry is it never stays still, there's always change. Mm. Fundamentally, I think our job as IT leaders is really about change management most of the time. Mm. I think in my three-something decades in IT, it's always been a period of change. You know, these days it's digital or it's cyber, but there's always been something that's coming, that's new, that feels like it's changing our ways of working, that's changing our operating model. It's challenging, but I think that's what makes it interesting. It's never boring.
Yeah.
Every 3 years, it feels like a whole new job.
Speaking of three, where do you see the industry heading in the next 3 to 5 years?
I don't think I'd be Robinson Crusoe in saying that cyber is going to continue to gain in importance. I'm pretty sure that will be the case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure resource constraints are going to continue to be challenging or become even more challenging. Although, as I said, I think vendors are in any case stepping up their capability to support that. I see a tendency increasingly to separate digital delivery from the rest of IT, and as I said before, I have some concerns about that, but I think it's important to ensure that the structure is carefully considered from an organisational lens, but also from an IT lens, and again, that's where I think the CIO has a really key role to play in influencing that. We could probably have an exciting debate about the decline of the CIO role and whether in 5 years' time it's going to kind of be emasculated down to a sort of operational keep the lights on role.
Mm.
I really hope it won't. Mm. I don't think it should be. I think IT is growing in importance, and I think that role should actually be growing. But I see a lot of challenges now with that crossover with digital that I think as an industry we need to solve, and maybe that's part of kind of educating and coaching that next generation of IT leaders that'll come after us, as in maybe passing on some of those lessons of the past, because I don't think it's different to the way it was before. We just call it different terms, but there's always been new forms of technology that have come down the horizon that IT divisions have struggled to cope with, or that other divisions of a company have felt maybe they could do better and cheaper. So I think there's been some lessons learned by many of us who've maybe been around for a while, and we've got a responsibility to pass that on.
100%. And it will be interesting to see where that goes. You know, with a lot of changes in organisations around the CIOs and the CTOs and all these other new role titles that are popping up left, right and centre, it's a wonder how those decisions are being made and what the impacts of that will be, and only time will tell, I guess. So we'll wait and see. Just one last question before I get into a couple of rapid fire questions. In your time as a CIO, most recently, what would you say is your most your biggest achievement, or the one that you're most proudest of?
I think to boil it down, ultimately I judge the success of the IT function or of a CIO role on three satisfaction measures, probably: my employees' satisfaction, my customers, their internal customers, and stakeholders, in other words, the C-suite, the board, the ELT, and so on. I think if you can excel on all three at the same time, you should be extremely pleased with yourself, and I think that's a rare thing because it's a tough job. But you know, as Meatloaf once sang, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. For me personally, I think what I remember with pride from Toyota is achieving very high satisfaction results from my employees and customers towards the end of our tenure. I think the management team overall worked extremely hard to achieve that. There was a lot of toil and sweat, but for me, I was very proud of just knowing that my staff were feeling engaged and enabled, and that I left behind a strong team that can continue. And certainly, I mean, I had, of course, the personal experience of leaving after a long time in an organisation, and I'm always going to remember the sort of the many touching messages that I got, support and gratitude from staff. There's nothing more satisfying, I think, than feeling that you've had a positive influence on someone's life in some way, whether it's contributing to their career advancement or whether it's a personal issue.
Mm-hmm. And providing support during the COVID situation, which obviously exasperated things. And to run a team of the size that you ran, like a $100 million budget and 300 people and supporting 10,000 in users, like, it's no easy feat to do that in amongst the complexity.
I mean, look, I think no senior role is ever easy, unfortunately, and leading a large team is always an incredibly difficult people management challenge. I certainly found it challenging and rewarding and frustrating and all of those things and more at various times. But you're right, especially during COVID, it was particularly, I think, taxing on all leaders to support people's personal issues. A lot of things came out of the woodwork that maybe otherwise wouldn't in normal circumstances. I found a lot of my time personally was spent just trying to, as best I can, support people through whatever issues they were struggling with.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of quick rapid-fire questions for you before we wrap up for today, Alice. What is your favourite holiday destination? I know you recently travelled. Is it one of those?
Well, I recently was fortunate enough to travel to Europe, and I certainly, we love Italy, but not a place you can go to all the time. But locally, favourite holiday destination is Palm Cove in Queensland. Beautiful place, and we love just doing nothing there.
It's the best, especially when you're working so frantically throughout the week. Yeah. What was the last book you read?
I read a book whose exact title escapes me, but it was about the Boeing 737 MAX crisis, the safety crisis they had, and the unfortunate fatalities and so on, and I found it very confronting, actually. As business books go, it kind of made me really reflect on the importance of culture and think back of, could something like that have ever happened at any of the places that I've worked? Could a culture allow that sort of stuff to happen where, you know, safety issues are being knowingly pushed under the carpet in favour of schedules or budgets and so on? So, yeah, really, really interesting book, I think, for people in a leadership role to reflect on.
And if you could go back in time and give your younger self, so think back to maybe secondary college, teenage years, what would that be?
I'm not sure that I would have listened to my advice back in secondary school. But,
fair enough.
but if I did, I'd probably say take some time to think about what you really want to do and make sure either you're already doing it or you're on a path towards doing it in the near future. It's kind of obvious, but I think a lot of people stumble into careers or jobs or companies where they're really not happy, but they feel that they have to do it because it's the next career step. It's more money, it's more status, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be happy at the end of the day, and it's hard to sometimes take that time to reflect on it when you're in the thick of a busy job. So when you do take time out, when you go to Palm Cove, for example, or wherever it is you go, just take the time to actually slow down and de-stress and think about, am I actually happy? Am I enjoying what I'm doing or not? And that answer will change over time as well. You might think at the start of your career that you want to be whatever it is, a CIO or a CEO or something. Maybe you do, maybe that'll change. So just regularly ask yourself, I think, that question.
Yeah, and make sure you're happy. Love it. How can people learn more about you or work with you or get more information about you? What's the best place?
At the moment, I'm just starting off in a new direction as an independent IT advisor. So I don't have a fancy website and so on yet, but I think my LinkedIn profile is probably the best place to start, and I'm progressively updating it with my advisory services. That's probably a good way to learn a bit about what I'm doing and to get in touch with me.
Perfect, that sounds good. I'll put that into the show notes. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, a call to action, a piece of advice, or a question to ponder?
Good question. I feel like I just gave my advice to my younger self then, but a call to action, I guess, would probably be think about the people aspect of your job more. I think whenever I've had regrets, I guess, in the past, or things that I would have wanted to do differently, it was almost always because there was a people issue. It was because I took too long to hire or promote someone that was deserving, or conversely, where I shouldn't have hired or promoted someone. And inevitably, it was because I waited too long to be proven right, even though I had a gut feel from the start. So I guess my call to action would probably be think more about the people aspects and back your intuitive judgment, because I think often we actually know the right thing to do, we just resist it for various reasons.
Some great advice. Thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you so much, Alice, for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I know we got to have coffee before as well, so that was also fun. So we had lots to talk about. But yeah, really appreciate your time and for you coming and visiting us today.
You too, Tim. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Please share this with someone or rate it if you enjoyed it. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and to stay up to date with all things Agile Ideas, go to our website www.agilemanagementoffice.com. I hope you've been able to learn, feel, or be inspired today. Until next time, What's your agile idea?